People's Republic of China has such a huge leverage dominating the refining, smelting, purification, separation, what have you. The middle of the value chain is critical minerals and often also mining. That if it was a force that's open to commercial rationality on a regular basis, as we hoped when we brought China to WTO in 2001, it wouldn't be a problem. Unfortunately, that's not the case. China showed an intention to weaponize this sector, first in 2010 against Japan, and since 2020, introduction of export control law, it has slapped about 24 different regulatory restrictions on exports of either these materials or related technology or IP related to both processing and sometimes even extraction of some of those. This is a weaponization that we have to pay attention to because we're just so dependent on the imports of these materials and some of the key products made of these materials from China.
Good day, everybody. It's me here, just Steve Yang with Natural Resource Stocks, where we mine for stories that matter. And today I am joined by Thomas Nedrowski, portfolio manager with MVEST, author of Mineral War, and macro thinker and investor in the space that we respect. Thomas, great to have you on here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks.
How are you?
Good. Thank you. A bit chilly in New York City, but that's probably El Nino.
Thomas, thank you for coming on. I really wanted to pick your brain as to understanding this world a little bit, but I kind of wanted to start with what you've published recently, Mineral War. If you can tell us about that book a bit, what inspired you to write it, and what does a mineral war look like in today's world?
Yeah, two reasons why I wrote this book. The first one is that I run the Critical Minerals Fund in New York City with my partners at MVEST Capital. And we're focusing entirely on those smaller markets, critical minerals, better materials, metals for specialty technologies, both civilian and military, as well as rare earths. And we found that allocators, so the ultimate sources of capital, do not necessarily understand this space. You know, mining is kind of peripheral in the United States. Critical minerals are the periphery of periphery, and there's more talk about it in Washington than it is in the market, really, until recently. So first, I wanted just people not to have the excuse that they don't understand this market. So that's the idea for the book. But more seriously, I think there's a disconnect between the language spoken in the market here, a couple of blocks down from here on Wall Street, and the language used in Washington. One is the language of markets and commercial rationality. The other one is the language of geopolitics. Politics, geopolitics, geostrategy. And what I was trying to do in this book is just connect these two languages as I'm evolving mostly on this side here in New York City. But I think I have a pretty good understanding of how geopolitics could be actually exploited for investment purposes. And that's exactly what we're trying to do in our fund. So these were sort of the two objectives. It was fun writing it, not so much fun publishing. I don't think this is a growth business anymore. But, you know, I strongly encourage those who would like to understand why we are here, why we're in this crisis in this market, and why China is so dominant in this space and across different materials. So I dig into this in quite detail in the book.
Awesome. Thomas, you live in New York. You talked about the differences in language with, you know, markets and geopolitics. Now, how important are critical minerals, and why do you think so many people still underestimate or misunderstand their strategic importance and in bringing geopolitics into this?
You see, usually, historically in the markets, we only cared about geopolitics when it affected energy, right? Big energy, oil and gas. We still do, obviously, because of what's going on this year. But that was the only time. You know, with North Koreans lobbed a missile somewhere over, the ocean, the market sort of took a note for 2 hours and just went back to its, you know, daily obsession with earnings or whatever other, you know, short-term issues. This is a bit different. This is something that has accumulated over three decades of negligence, both of negligence from the capital market that didn't want to support this industry, and from the policymakers who thought that, you know, just in time is great and borders don't matter, and everybody will have commercial rationality. And I think at the latest, we realize with Putin's invasion of Ukraine that commercial rationality is not the only one, right? There was no commercial reason for Russia to destroy its largest European gas market. They did it for other reasons. And the problem is that the dominant force here, which is the People's Republic of China, has such a huge leverage dominating the refining, smelting, purification, separation, what have you. The middle of the value chain is critical minerals and often also mining. That if it was a force that's open to commercial rationality on a regular basis, as we hoped when we brought China to WTO in 2001, it wouldn't be a problem. Unfortunately, that's not the case. China showed an intention to weaponize this sector, first in 2010 against Japan, and since 2020, introduction of export control law, it has slapped about 24 different regulatory restrictions on exports of either these materials or related technology or IP related to both processing and sometimes even extraction of some of those. This is a weaponization that we have to pay attention to because we're just so dependent on the imports of these materials and some of the key products made of these materials from China.
Thomas, if you can give us a brief history lesson or what happened in 2010. For those of us who don't know, in Japan in particular, 2020 as well, and love to kind of pick your brain a little bit more on what you mean by weaponizing and how exactly that's happening.
So in 2010, there was the first attempt by Beijing to use rare earths as a sort of whip over a completely non-commercial issue. There was a standoff over Senkaku Islands that both the PRC and Japan claim. Administratively, Japan has the authority over this part of the Western Pacific, but China claims it should be part of China. In reality, as I explain in the book, there were problems in terms of reserve replacement for rare earth production in China. So the outflow of rare earths already dwindled before the crisis, which was triggered by a Chinese fisherman who just intruded into Japanese waters, was apprehended by the Coast Guard. And of course, that led to a massive outpouring of nationalist sentiment in China. And there was a perception that the subsequent ban on exports of rare earths to Japan, which was and still is the largest client of China in this sector, it was viewed as a sort of a retaliation. Now, the reason why it eventually failed is that at that time, many producers, rare earth producers in China were private operators, especially in the southern part of the country. And they managed to, of course, clinch that massive premium that, you know, the prices, of course, went through the roof when this ban was instigated. And they managed to smuggle material out of the country and sort of skin the cat on the occasion. Precedent of the market winning over the state was never forgotten by the Chinese Communist Party, and they have pledged since then to consolidate this sector, in which really, when it comes to, say, processing of heavier herbs, it's all done in China. 99% of all the processing of heavier herbs is processed in China. And therefore, they decided to sort of, widen the moat a bit and built up the bailey and control the outflows and indeed inflows much better, which to their credit, they have achieved quite a significant extent over the subsequent 16 years. Accelerating this process, as I said, with that law in 2020 during COVID called export control. So today it would be much more difficult for whatever remaining independent operators in China to smuggle the material out. And I'm saying whatever remaining because the country went through several waves of consolidation of this sector with mergers mostly benefiting state-owned enterprises or state-directed enterprises. Some of them may have been launched by private operators who used to work in the administration of the of the mining land and resources ministry in China, but their balance sheets are controlled essentially by state-owned banks, so they're not really independent entities. And therefore, today, it would be much more difficult for independent smugglers to kind of run against the writ of the Chinese Communist Party, unlike in 2010. Now, back to weaponization. Let me give you an example which is not related to China. I think the best example is Russian gas policy in the 2010s in Europe, where Russia decided to have this differential attitude depending on its own strategic goals. Geoeconomics, that's what it is, using economic levers to achieve strategic goals that may not be economic at all. And so with the pipelines running through Ukraine, the Baltics and Poland into Germany, the idea was let's just connect Germany, the most powerful economy of the European Union, to the Russian gas and oil to some extent, by offering them discounts, by basically addicting the entire chemical industry of Germany to its dependence on inflows from Russia. And meanwhile, let's be a little more differential in terms of what we consider our sphere of influence, Eastern Europe, former Eastern Europe, former Comecon, former Soviet republics. And that was played both in terms of pricing and volumes. Sometimes volumes were turned down, and indeed, they were actually turned down against even to Germany to avoid building up stockpiles ahead of the war in Ukraine many, many months before. So that's part of the broader palette that totalitarian regimes that do not really adhere to our sort of commercial rules on global trade, this is how they use it. Because if you, I compare, I think in my book, Russia's attempts to what Australia does. Australia has had a number of trade conflicts with China, but it never tried to punish its largest client for iron ore. That is the PRC, right? That's simply not what you know, free countries do. Now, we might be forced to act this way because, as I entitled the book, this is a mineral war, and therefore we no longer in a sort of social operating mode of competition and cooperation, but we have moved to a completely different stage of development of sort of a conflict with a lot of proxy wars, as we know, around the world that are part of that process, unfortunately. But it doesn't mean that we should despair in the markets. As I said before, this is also an opportunity for some of these markets that have to be rebuilt in the West. And we invest them precisely in that opportunity.
Thomas, I am struck by a couple words that you've mentioned. One is we talked about weaponization, weaponize. And when I think of weaponize, I think of sanctions. I think of, you know, weaponizing the dollar. I think of, you know, we're talking about levers. And then the other, you know, I hear you say punish. And then I also hear you in this, the subtitle of the book I was intrigued by, China's Quest for Weapons of Mineral Destruction. That's an interesting title. I'd love to, for you to elaborate on that a little bit. But, you know, when I hear those words, I think of, you know, balance of power. I think of, you know, maybe I'm intrigued by your particular angle of China. I'd love to know what you think are, you know, who are the key players in the global competition over critical minerals, and how do you see the balance of power evolving?
Yeah, this is a broader question, of course, because a lot has to do with the changing role of the United States in the global context. And we see it maybe not so much with China, because it's difficult to read what that policy actually is. Maybe there's something else we see on surface with this, you know, almost kowtowing style trip to Beijing today. And it may be something very different, you know, in subsurface, of which I know like nothing, because I don't have any security clearance. And if I had, I wouldn't be speaking on it on the public podcast. However, from what is visible is the U.S. approach to other theaters. So, say European theater. There's no denying that U.S. is slowly moving away from its hegemonic position in Europe. That is historically called, in sort of history of strategy, offshore balancing. This is what UK or Britain used to do vis-a-vis the rest of Europe, sort of staying a bit outside and then balancing different powers throughout the 19th century, sometimes on this side, sometimes on that side, long-term conflict with France, but then joining France against Russia in Crimean War, and then Germany arises as a biggest competitor. That seems to be, according to some strategists, the approach that's being adopted by the United States since this new administration joined, simply because the U.S. doesn't have the means anymore to be this global hegemon, you know, taking care of everyone and everything. Now, How this plays out in reality, it's difficult to say. Definitely, there's been a change in terms of execution since the beginning of this year, as we saw in Venezuela and Iran. It's difficult to match this with the national security strategy that was issued last November, which really sometimes reads as if it was written by four different authors pulling in different directions with different theaters. There's no doubt, however, in my mind, that Asia is the fastest growing part of the world, the most sophisticated from the manufacturing perspective, China being part of that. And therefore, it is the key theater if you want to ensure, the economic future and especially our digital future as well, that depends on Taiwan to a very, very large extent. So that's the key thing. So the U.S. activity is both the reaction to rising powers elsewhere, which are adversarial by their own definition. In the case of Xi Jinping, this was a 2013 document number 9, in which he defined the Western institution and Western values as enemies of the Chinese Communist Party. We might have dismissed this document back then, but it is the founding document of Chinese strategy ever since. And then the U.S. is also doing this because simply doesn't have the means, doesn't have the manufacturing capacity, doesn't have a military power. It still has the dollar that you mentioned, still has presence in the outer space and the orbits and so on. So there are still elements that are lingering there, and they may help U.S. maintain this sort of different stance of offshore balancing. It's not entirely new. Nixon's doctrine, the so-called Guam Doctrine, introduced in 1971. During his trip to Asia, was also going in this direction. There was the view, look, Southern Vietnamese, we saw it, but we're not going to be all dying on your hills anymore. We're winning all the battles. We're unable to win the war. Please take care of this business yourself. We'll be just supporting you sort of from further, we not being directly involved. And Asians, took it to heart at that time, and South Vietnam disappeared. There is some precedent in history, and there is little doubt in my mind that Nixon's presidency was the last really revolutionary presidency in terms of the role of the United States. And of course, what we have afterwards, the petrodollar with William Simon traveling to Saudi Arabia in 74. I think we're seeing something just as fundamentally transforming for the role of the United States around the world right now. Where it's going, Steve, I'd love to know. We continue.
So, Tom, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. I spoke with Tom Luongo, I think, last week, and he had an interesting angle I have yet to hear elsewhere. But it's like we hear about the BRICS nations, and we hear China, like you said, they see the Western nations as the enemies or the competitions or whatever. But I heard Tom talk about the perspective. Maybe instead of talking about BRICS, we should be talking about ARC, America, Russia, and China, where they're more cordial and working things out. It's kind of more the issue or the tension is really between, like, let's say the United States and Britain, London, or whatever, and just Europe. And where Russia, China, and America, not allies, but more cordial. Is there any, what do you, I love your thoughts on that perspective. And then I'd love to get your thoughts on, where China sees the war, like who's China's mineral war against, and what's US's greatest threat at this time?
Just on minerals, there's definitely no mineral war between China and Russia. Russia is advancing faster than anybody would predict it. Its own rare earth supply chain, which was as inefficient as many others in the West, with certain nodes in the value chain missing. And for some reason, they obtained technology. Either it was a quid pro quo with China, or maybe someone managed to just appropriate it that illegally. It's hard to say. So on that arc, in this love triangle, one party will be very unhappy, and right now this party is the United States. The attempt to do a reverse Kissinger and splinter somehow Russia and China, build a little more of space between those two and enter into this relationship on a triangular basis. So far, it has failed, and it's failed because of how vital Russia is for Chinese nuclear program, for Chinese military technology and how important Chinese support has been for Russia during the Ukrainian war. Now, is it going to change after the Ukrainian war? It's up to the Russian elites to decide. In Russia, there are like historically two different views of the world. One is what you call Zapadniki, who look west, and Vostochniki, who look east. Right now, Vostochniki have their field day. Really looking east is the solution. Of course, it hasn't been particularly good for the Russian economy with the replacement of local brands with Chinese brands, but who cares during the war, right? Just keeping the engine going. This is what has mattered enormously with components flooding the market from China. It is important for China because this is the long border with historical frictions, but not just frictions, because if you see the history between the two nations long before communism, so Nerchinsk treaty in the 17th century, this was the first treaty that Chinese emperors signed with another power, which they really didn't know, on an equal basis. All the other deals between China and its neighbors were basically sort of vassalage deals, right? Between China and its vassals. At least this is the way it was portrayed in the capital. That was not the case with Russia. And it's very interesting to read this and how these relations have evolved ever since. Yes, they had some lows, and precisely during, you know, Nixon times, there was an opportunity to extract here. But it's currently a very, very strong bond for a variety of reasons. And part of the reasons why China is relatively protected from what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz is because of its overland relation to both Russia and Turkmenistan. There are other reasons, of course, you know, corridors for Pakistan and Burma and significant stockpiling and successful efforts to domicile this energy sourcing, whether it's coal or green energy, and of course, EVs for transportation. So there are many levers here, but the partnership with Russia is important. Back to BRICS for a moment. This is some mirage that doesn't exist and not going to exist. Despite that strong relationship that you have between Russia and China, the other additions are a little bit metaphorical. What happens to Brazil, we'll see after the next election, right? It's really up in the air. And you know, I chuckle when I see a BRICS member, Iran, bombing a BRICS hopeful Qatar. That's not much love lost there.
I spoke with Keith Wiener. He said, what did the BRICS nations have in common besides I hate America? It's like nothing. So like there's nothing that keeps them together. So you're saying that it's a mirage. What's a mirage for? What's the end there?
Precisely for what you said. Just to sort of promote this idea that the world is changing, that the Western world is falling, and the, you know, Eastern world supposedly rising, and around that Eastern core, the global South will somehow coalesce. Well, tell it, you know, to the 100,000 Indian soldiers that are manning the line of actual control in the Himalaya, how fantastic that project is, right? So it's not, you know, it is a talk shop, you know, hasn't even issued any statement regarding this war, because the views regarding this war, you know, differ in different parts of BRICS. And the Middle East itself is splitting. It's splintering right now, right? With Saudi Arabia and Pakistan maybe trying to build an alliance with Turkey and Qatar, and UAE sort of siding closer with India, Israel, and the United States. So it's, you know, it's a world in movement more than something, you know, cast in stone here. So I wouldn't pay too much attention to BRICS. It's long gone since, you know, O'Neill's idea of a investable universe or large economies that would grow. They've gone in very different directions, each of them, since then.
So who is primarily pushing the BRICS narrative?
Well, of course, Russia and China do, and the entire global South thing. So I tell you something interesting I heard from a cyber expert in Japan. Much of the anti-American and anti-Western propaganda is being promoted by a number of Chinese channels around the world in the global South, of course, in Africa, where China managed to, you know, recolonize a lot of these countries, making them dependent both on the capital account and the trade account. But the content is not necessarily created in China. China doesn't have a particularly good cultural sensitivity. Actually, they find it difficult to understand that smaller countries can have agency. So they think only in terms of, the large ones, America and Russia, and already Europe is a little too complicated for them. So the content, believe it or not, is actually generated in Russia. The content for all this, they are pretty good at, since 19th century, long before the Soviets, finding somewhere a social, political, economic cleavage, deepening this, widening this, amplifying this, and maybe then intervening to protect someone, and then here it is, new status quo, we staying, right? This is the Russian model. The Chinese have adopted this. They're a little bit less knowledgeable about outside world than Russians are, and Russians have this advantage of really spanning very different cultures, the Muslim culture, the Far East, they're sort of Europeans. The Chinese don't have that. They're very, very, very solipsistic in a way culturally. So, look at our neighbors here, can live here in this country for 20 years without speaking English. It's not unique to just specifically the system right now, just simply something in the culture. So, but they have the power, diplomatic power, and the media power around the world, and the social media power to amplify that Russian concocted message that, hey, global South is coming back. Forget about the West. It works in some ways if you want to, complicate the routes of travel for the Taiwanese president to a country in Africa. But otherwise, it's really a negative message against U.S. Is it gonna work? It's enough to travel to Africa and ask locals what they think about working for Chinese companies. That I have to go into details, but I'm sure you imagine what it is. So locals have their own view, but elites decide what happens in those countries, not the locals.
Thomas, you mentioned Taiwan, and you previously mentioned that you see the main theater perhaps being in Asia. Like, we also, I mean, I don't know if these are words that you, I don't think these are words you specifically said, but correct me if I'm wrong. Is I get the sense that maybe China had the foresight to, see certain things that maybe other nations didn't, and maybe U.S. is playing a little bit of catch up with all these things that are going on with these wars and stuff. Love to get your thoughts on, where does Taiwan come in? Is that something that's heavily on the U.S. radar? Does U.S. have critical mineral motivation there, or is it something else?
Well, our motivation is that 35% of our equity market depends on what happens in Hsinchu Science Park in Taiwan, right? So if that's gone, then we've thrown 20 years backwards in terms of AI. Goodbye Claude and Perplexity, Gemini, OpenAI, and so on, and many more things. So it's just, the idea that you can just transplant one TSMC plant to Arizona and solve the problem this way, this is like a 19th century thinking. There's an entire ecosystem around this. And
So that's
so,
not going to work, is what you're saying.
no, I mean, whatever works is they're going to be dependent on everything else from Taiwan to staff and man this plant and every component. So, some people are a little more honest about it. When you see Jensen Huang presenting for NVIDIA, he stands in front of that Taiwan map, and there's about 100 of Taiwanese companies mentioned as contractors and subcontractors for this massive value chain. Let's not forget these things. Of course, at the end of the day, we're coming to minerals, right? But between minerals, then there are different products, components, alloys, and so on that go into those different products that then feed into, say, lithography or, etching, doping, deposition, or what have you, and chip making. But these are very complex supply chains. I mean, TSMC probably 2,000, over 2,000 suppliers. ASML in the Netherlands claim to have 4,000. So it's not just one factory. This is how it's gone. Now I'm all in favor of reindustrialization of the United States and the West, by the way, because the only industrial powers left within our institutional West, and I explain what I mean by that institutional West in my book. The only ones that are still manufacturing powers are Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea. These are the only ones that have manufacturing to GDP, in high teens or above. All the other countries, whether it's Europe, U.S., Canada, Australia, de-industrialized, have de-industrialized over the globalization period because, just in time was in vogue. But just in time was invented by the Japanese in 1953. So I think we're kind of late to the party in the 90s. Anyway, so that. that world is over. Now the question is, how can we leverage our alliance with those different nations to rebuild parts of it that would be profitable? Large scale smelting and refining of metals is probably the most difficult one because you need a lot of volume to do this. And therefore, it's difficult to just rebuild it on a small scale. But from that perspective, Korean investment in Tennessee is very, very, very important. So there is some hope, you know, that something is happening. Now, we also have to function according to Xi Jinping's calendar because he gave us a reprieve last year in Busan in South Korea in November for about a year, suspending four of 24 different restrictions. And that runs out in November. Now, let's see what happens over the next 2 days in Beijing and whether we hear anything about it. What I see is that heavy rare earths are not being exported to the volume as it was as they were before 2025, which means that whatever agreement was reached in Busan, China is not complying with it.
So, Thomas, I know that we got Beijing coming up, and then is there anything particular you're keeping an eye on? And then love to get your thoughts on, is China was were they just faster? Are they better positioned? Do they have control of supply chain? Is there a part of their strategy that you find either impressive or superior? And is the West able to catch up? And do you find that the U.S. government is responding with enough urgency?
There are elements that are really impressive, certainly in terms of the focus of the educational system, focus on actually making things, making widgets. So focusing on, you know, a 3D reality rather than everything being digital and software based. That's quite impressive in terms of a number of engineers they churn out to maintain excellence in many of these sectors, whether it's battery making or magnet making and so on. Because what happens is that over long term, you actually learn by doing. You actually have to make something to improve incrementally that you know manufacturing excellence. And you cannot take it away from you know the talent and the genius of Chinese engineers and how far they pushed some of these inventions, which were Western inventions. So
Okay.
I'm never going to be critical of that. That's their absolute right, and they're super smart doing this. What I'm objecting to is, of course, weaponization of that massive dominance by a country that, you know, if you read some of that Beijing propaganda, I think last week I read something, they are gloating that they will never allow America to reindustrialize, that rare earths are just the beginning. And, you know, this is the system that was introduced by Xi Jinping for this decade, Shuang-Xinhuan, dual circulation, right? So making the world dependent on the Chinese economic system and making Chinese economy independent of the outside world. That's worse than autarky, right? That's actually the core of that weaponization. So it's gonna take a long time for the West to, you know, first, you know, the West has woken up finally, but now rebuilding this with very different policies between Japan, US, Europe, some better than others, I think it would have been much better if we actually cooperated much more closely on that between allies. I think there is some inkling in this direction. Certainly the Japan-US cooperation or Korea-US cooperation are better than the European-US, not to mention Canada. It's partly an enemy country right now. But you know there is a lot more that can be done. And I think now under so much pressure, there will be breakthroughs and there will be deals that will allow this sector to become a little more independent of China. Not within one electoral cycle, though.
Thomas, we talked about the weaponization is what you have an issue with. What would you say from the other angle? Or, I mean, I'm sure there'd be a lot of countries that say, well, America weaponizes the dollar. What's the difference there? And I'd love your thoughts on that. And then, two, I'd love to get just kind of a broad view of what is critical minerals. Are we talking about, why is that so important? Is there anything in particular you think is needs to be addressed, and if you can tell my audience just kind of what's at stake here.
Two very different areas. So dollar weaponization, it's exactly the same mistake that China is making weaponizing critical minerals. Because at the end of the day, if you sanction so many countries with access to the dollar and the SWIFT system and the clearance system, at the end of the day, you're going to run out of that firepower. because other countries will develop alternative payment system, maybe bilateral, maybe more expensive in a way, less efficient. But efficiency is no longer really the name of a game because we're past that just-in-time era in the world, right? If efficiency was the name of a game, then a Strait of Hormuz would be open today. Other countries will be looking for other opportunities. It's going to be difficult. We saw it at the beginning of the war in Ukraine. Russia and India set up, new payment system for Russian oil that suddenly flowed in, large volumes to India for the first time. So since the war started, but Indians paid with rupees. So at some point, there was a big pile of rupees in Moscow that Russia couldn't do much about. There wasn't that much to buy from India. So it's complicated, but it's possible. And likewise, weaponization of rare earths and other critical minerals eventually will lead to some other solutions that may not be ideal, maybe technologically somewhat inferior, but substitution in minerals and commodities in general is, has always existed. It's always something as an investor I have to pay attention to. Now, what makes a material critical? Three things. One is supply constraints. One is demand, especially structural growth in demand. And the third one is substitution risk. So precisely what I mentioned before, per different element. Now, in times of competition, you can lay out these three along a number of different aspects: efficiency, proficiency, economics, environmental considerations, and so on. In times of conflict, the number one dimension is going to be time. How quick can I get it? And how safely can I get it? Am I getting it domestically? Am I getting it from an allied country? Am I getting it from a neutral party somewhere sitting on the fence, like Brazil or Malaysia? Or am I getting it from an adversary, which is, of course, complicated because the adversary could also weaponize it. So it is, there are several other examples. Now, China would argue that the US is weaponizing access to chips, to semiconductors. So US designed, Taiwanese made, sometimes memory chips from Korea, with technologies, Netherlands, Japan, Germany, some other key countries in that value chain, that the high-end chip, the top chain, say Blackwell chips, are not available in the Chinese market. The difference, however, between critical minerals and those high-end chips is the high-end chips speak about something in future, some kind of digital future that we only seeing now slowly kind of emerge on our screens and in robotics and beyond. Whereas critical minerals affect us today. If we're deprived of rare earths, oxides, rare earth oxides are maybe $6 billion worth of market, or at least were at the beginning of this year. The downstream value of this is about 10 trillion. So it's a significant chunk, even for a US economy. And so stopping flows of these materials basically just shuts down manufacturing today, not the day after tomorrow in some kind of technological nirvana, but today. And so that's the difference between the two. And weaponization, as I said, giving this example of Russia, weaponization is also used by those powers by using access to their market. Now, this you can say US has been reacting with tariffs, some of these tariffs introduced in a very naive way without much homework done. Turns out that they were illegal. But there are other tariff systems that may be legal and indeed maybe even important to rebuild these sectors, because the prices with which they are sold to the West reflect a demand curve that is specific for the Chinese market, domestic market, not the demand curvature of the Western market that's really starved for these materials. So that's just super incentive to rebuild certain industries, and there's a lot of sort of economic work on that. What you do to develop infant industry, which is really maybe a returning infant industry.
Thomas, as an investor, I love to shift gears, and I mean you're a portfolio manager, love to get your thoughts on where you think investors and markets are still misreading the critical minerals story. Are there particular narratives you find especially compelling, and where do you think investors should be most careful?
I would encourage investors to really look at those different deals that are currently under the umbrella of major bilateral agreements, say US Australia or EU Australia, US Japan, US Korea, and so on, because some of those deals actually make sense from the perspective of connecting the value chains where there is really no connectivity right now. Because these supply chains, if you just take away China and its allies, so say Myanmar, maybe Tajikistan, Russia, and so on, then suddenly you find yourself with a lot of holes in that. The investment thesis that we are following, yes, we're very interested in, an exciting exploration project or development project or mining project. The closer to cash, the better. But we want to know how that connects with the rest of the supply chain redevelopment, because you can no longer just drill a hole in this space and they say, okay, I'm going to just sell it to China, which was the name of the game for, 25 years of globalization, right? This is what miners did. They still do in many of those sort of older commodities. But in critical minerals, it's really, a bifurcated world. You either serve that market or you serve the Western market. So, you'll find there are going to be some names that are maybe unfamiliar to mining investors, Japanese component companies, Korean component companies, maybe some Taiwanese companies. It's worth understanding a little bit beyond the mine gate what happens with the product and how critical it is, not just for the very large civilian market, but also for the military market. And because there's such an amazing growth in military budgets around the world, whether in Australia, Germany, Japan, Canada, US, and so on. And so this is growing. And of course, as we're wasting so much material and in the Middle East, stockpiling of some of these critical materials, heavy equipment, it's going to happen sooner rather than later. So yes, there's a lot to parse through beyond your typical work on, this is the drilling grid. This is what I need for a conversion from resources to reserves. This is the annual tonnage. Let's go and look at the cost. That's a little more than that.
So with any investment, there's research and and nothing's a guarantee. But how when you look at supply chains and value chains and how how that's affected and all that, how much of that is guesswork, theoretical, and how do you as a portfolio manager, how do you approach evaluating opportunities? Are there important questions you look at, ask any metrics? And if you can tell me a little bit more how you assess the value chain part of it.
Yeah, so we start really with the product or commodity. So we're looking at, maybe 40 different metals that are of, often rather small metals that sometimes come as byproducts, usually at the mining level, and have to be separated in the flow sheet a little later on. So we're looking, okay, where do we want to be? Do we want to be in this really exciting mining project, or is it actually better to be just a notch later? In refining process, because this is going to create an input to a compound which is particularly important for this technology or that technology. Now, to do this properly, you need a large database with a lot of comps. And comparing, say, rare earth companies, especially when you have 16 different elements, I mean, theoretically 17, but in reality 16 different elements, it's important to understand what the differences are across different types of geology. Predominantly, really, in terms of, okay, do I want to be more in yttrium or do I want to be more in gadolinium? And where does it go to? So, back to the value chain question, right? The first question I'm asking, anybody, so what do you think you're going to sell? What is the product? Is it a monazite concentrate, mixed rare earth carbonate, mixed oxide, separate oxide, maybe? You want to go downstream? Just tell me where and on what money. So, it's all important. And then the decision is, of course, which market to serve. And this is an evolving situation. I still think the structural change is only just starting. So back to valuation, we don't really factor in those Chinese prices because we see them as just not sustainable to incentivize investment in the West. That's an opportunity because right now the valuation of most of these equities, they don't kick in a huge premium. But I can assure you that if we just wasted a third of or a fourth or more of our missiles, and we have to stockpile a particular element that is important for electromagnetic warfare, then the military contractors will outbid everybody else and therefore push the price up because it's so important for them to get it rather than to get it to make a larger profit. So that's something that has to be factored in. And I would think we're just at the beginning of structural change, which I would time probably started with the MP Materials deal last summer when the government announced, the price floor specifically for that company. Maybe not a great deal in itself, but it sent a signal to the market, you know what, we're moving away from the prices that are determined somewhere else. And by the way, China is not comfortable with foreign prices either, right? This is why they set up iron ore monopsony that state owned to control the purchase of iron ore from Australia and Brazil. This is why they're very uncomfortable about uranium pricing. They want to develop their own uranium index. They're going to do it, given that all uranium on the territory of China should be controlled by Chinese state-owned entities. I don't know. But there is a flow of uranium, of course, from Kazakhstan over land. So it's possible to actually determine some price flow. I think this is a broader bifurcation. On the one hand, sadly, it happens to a market that was very connected. The mining business was very connected across the world. When I worked in business development, a very large mining company in the past, the geologist colleague who was in charge of exploration, with whom I worked doing valuation on projects, had this map in the office in Johannesburg. And we had nearly 100 companies there with different pins, of which a large chunk we actually visited looking for projects. It's not possible anymore. That map is just shrunken to something much more limited. I'm not ecstatic about it. I would have rather had the world as we knew it before, but the reality is what it is, and I have to face it as an investor, as a human being.
Thomas, before we wrap up, if you can tell us about Amvest, what's that all about, and how can it potentially serve our listeners, and then how can people find you?
Yeah, so Amvest Capital was set up by two partners, Gabriel Alonso Mendoza and Stuart McLiver, I think 2017, serving mining companies, predominantly exploration development companies initially, introducing them to the U.S. market. Campbell McCrory is one colleague who has an amazing network. They're bringing companies to and in front of retail companies. This is also now a broker dealer. So it's becoming an important company in the U.S. sort of mining interface with the outside world, with very strong connectivity both in Australia and Canada. So some of this trend for the non-U.S. companies, including those London listed, thinking about doing business in U.S. In this space and maybe relisting, that's opportunity for that side of the business. I'm on the other side of the business. I'm on the buy side. I run asset management side of this. So I'm the Terraden Critical Mineral Funds. Investing exclusively in critical minerals outside of the Chinese value chain. The name Amvest is part of the group, and Terraden stands for Terra Den, Terra for Earth, and Den in Japanese means electricity, or Dien in Chinese. So the electricity from the ground, that's the idea of the name. And so we can be found on amvestteraden.com. We publish a weekly newsletter on different developments. Some of them are securities related. Some of them are related to supply chain developments or geopolitical insights as well, which in our view drive a lot of the shift in value in this space.
For everyone listening, I'll be putting Thomas's links and socials in the show notes. Thomas, has been awesome learning from you. Lots to think about, and thanks for teaching me what you see and how you navigate this world here. For everyone listening, I'm just Steve Yang, learning alongside you from interesting, intelligent people like Thomas Nodrowski. Everybody stay smart, stay curious, stay disciplined. Thomas, it's a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me.